This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Diane Rehm is one of the most popular people on NPR. The Diane Rehm Show has been a fixture on this station and others around the country, about 200 or more, reaching millions of people every single day. She broke new ground behind the scenes in broadcasting, becoming one of the first or few female voices on radio at a time when you didn't hear many women on the air. And she continues to break ground with incisive yet polite interviews and conversations with the major personalities of our day, from politicians to movie and recording stars, from scientists to great thinkers and, of course, authors. Diane Rehm is to writers what Johnny Carson was to comedians, giving them invaluable exposure to a nationwide audience. Now, I guess you could say that when it comes to writers of books, she was Oprah before there was an Oprah. But very soon, Diane Rehm, herself an author, will start writing a new chapter in her own life. She's preparing to retire, but before she does, she is traveling around the country, visiting with stations and their listeners who have been an integral part of her success. And this hour, Diane Rehm joins us. Welcome back to Charlotte and to the program. It's great to see you again.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
Two things before we start. Listeners should know that we're doing something that you do on a regular basis on your show. We are broadcasting this show, a video of this conversation, on our Facebook page. You can go to or search for WFAE on Facebook in order to see this conversation. And secondly, our weekly news roundup will return next Friday, an idea we stole blatantly from you, and it's become one of our most popular features. It will be back next week.
Good.
You never intended to be a radio interviewer.
Absolutely not. It was totally by accident and I don't know what else.
What would your life have been like had you not stumbled into this, do you think?
Well, I was doing some fashion modeling.
That's not hard to believe. By
well, I was doing that for quite a while, and but my children had reached a point where I knew I wanted to do something that mattered. Fashion modeling was great, but when I had to walk the runway at a country club with a bathing suit on and a cover-up, and then take that cover-up off and walk that runway in a bathing suit, I thought, this is it for me. Not happy to do this. So I knew something else was coming, but I didn't know what it was. That one day I stepped into the doors at WAMU and was on the air that very first day as a volunteer because the host was out sick and the manager was going to do the show. She invited me into the studio. I was hooked for life.
Really? That was in the early 70s. Right. When you were talking about runway modeling, that strikes me as something you have to have a lot of courage to do that. You have to have a lot of self-confidence to do that. You have to have a real security in your body image, et cetera. That's those same things, I would think, played a role in enabling you to step behind this microphone and talk to the caliber of people that you've been able to talk to over the years.
Or in the early days, pretend that you had the courage to do
exactly
that.
Right. Exactly right.
Because walking the runway, you say it takes a lot of self-confidence. I cannot tell you how little self-confidence I had in those days, how little I had in the early days of broadcasting. But I've always believed that when you set out to do something, you have to carry it through. Mm-hmm. And that's all I could do was to put one foot in front of the other.
You walked in the door at WAMU in 1973.
Right.
By 1979, your show was on NPR nationwide.
No.
Okay.
My boss retired in 1979, called me, said she was retiring, and I put my name in with 100 other people across the country for the host job. I was fortunate enough to get it. It was renamed. It was, at the time I took it, Kaleidoscope. It was renamed in 1984, The Diane Rehm Show. NPR did not take the show national until 1995, after I personally, Mike, had raised $250,000 to make sure that stations across the country would have the show free for 2 years. In those days, that was the only way. You had to pay your own way. And when my boss told me I had to raise $250,000, I thought, okay, I'll do it. And I went to a friend for the first $5,000, and I raised it in 3 months.
That's an amazing story.
Well, you know.
Who do you know? I want to meet them.
Someday you may.
So it took about 20 years to get onto the network.
Right.
And now you're nationwide. You're on NPR Worldwide. You're on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You're on the Armed Forces Radio Network. How do you walk away from all of that?
Well, I have always felt it was a good thing to walk away before anybody wanted you to walk away. Mm. I will be 80 years old in September, and I feel it's time for younger voices, younger ideas, younger presentations to have the benefit that I have had for 37 years, a voice at the microphone. I'll be doing a podcast after I leave, a once weekly podcast, which will not require that I get up at 5 a.m. every single morning.
Right.
And that's going to be a big relief.
Your schedule, because I only do half of what you do. I only do 1 hour. So your schedule has got to be backbreaking for a 20-year-old. I cannot believe you're doing this at 80, 2 hours a day. People have no earthly idea of the preparation that it takes to do the kind of interviews that you do. You have to know things walking in the door. You just don't learn.
You're right. 37 years, Mike, you accumulate that kind of information. So I go into an interview with all the notes one could possibly have about whatever that subject matter is. I go in with questions that have been prepared for me by the producer in charge that day, with answers to those questions. So I know enough to ask good questions. And when there are three or four people in the studio, you never know where the conversation is going to go. I have always felt our programs, like this one, should be called listening shows rather than talk shows, because you and I must do more listening than talking. And if we do not learn the art of listening, that program is not going to be successful.
Do you ever reflect on your success? And when you do, are you astounded by it? Because you have been, not only are you successful, you are beloved. There are very few people in this business who are beloved.
It's so kind of you to say. I have never stopped to think about, or to say to myself, to look in the mirror and say, you are successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just not part of my upbringing. my mother and father came here from abroad. My father came here from Beirut, Lebanon. My mother came here from Alexandria, Egypt. And self-confidence was not something that was built into me. We were not allowed as children, my sister and I, to question anything that was in the household. That is the way we were brought up. And the idea of college for Arab girls was simply not in the picture. So, of course, I went to work as a secretary right after I got out of high school and brought part of my salary always home to my parents. I mean, so the idea of thinking about myself as successful is not something I would do.
Well, let me just say that you are.
Thank you.
And you came along, as I said, at a time when women were not on radio and television as much as they are today. It was a rarity and a kind of a special thing. Did it prove to be at all a challenge for you personally, or a challenge for you to get guests to take you seriously because you were a woman? And if you're like me and almost everybody else in this business, I'm sure you learned what you do as you did it. No one sat down with you and said, now let's do this, this, and this. You kind of learn this job as you do it.
Absolutely. And for years into the job, I said to my boss, you know, I'm bored. Because I was following in the mode of my predecessor, doing very soft topics, and in the meantime, becoming more and more aware and interested and excited about politics and what was going on in the world. So I said to my boss, Craig Oliver, who was just a terrific program director, that I was ready to do harder news, wanting to get into the issues of the day, to take one topic, perhaps, from Morning Edition, the national NPR show, and expand on that idea. He was all for it. The show was renamed the Diane Rehm Show. We revamped the whole thing. I was learning as I was going. And in doing so, people in Washington began to pay attention. And the first person I called for the first revamped show was Hobart Rowan, who at the time was the economics correspondent for the Washington Post. I'll never forget how seriously he took me.
Wow. Diane Rehm is our guest, obviously, because her voice doesn't need to be introduced. She's with us for the hour. The weekly news roundup will continue next week, but we could not pass up this opportunity to talk to the queen of National Public Radio, and that's essentially what you are. We'll come back and talk about a lot of things with Diane Rehm. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura. Test drives available and new inventory now arriving daily for spring, including the new fuel-efficient 2017 Acura RDX. More at HendrickAcura.com. You know, many of us, I'm not going to point out anybody in the room, but many of us are addicted and don't even realize it. Not to drugs, but to our screens, to being connected, to being always on, always available, getting on the internet to surf, checking email, other things. Used to be cumbersome in those dial-up days of yesteryear, but now it's so easy to check in that we rarely check out. Allowing our technology to control our lives simply isn't healthy, and we're going to learn on Monday at 9 on this very program how to digitally detox. Thank you.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. A State Department review criticizes Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. Negative rhetoric ramps up on the campaign trail. And 11 states sue the federal government over the transgender bathroom directive.
Stay tuned for the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded public radio, where 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Diane Rehm is our guest in our Spirit Square studio. And by the way, if you care to, you can watch us on Facebook this morning. We are streaming live. Search for WFAE on Facebook if you'd like to see Diane Rehm in our studio as we have our conversation today. Our Friday News Roundup will come back next week. And by the way, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it via email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, or search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You were the first radio talk show host, I understand, to interview a sitting president in the Oval Office. President Obama, I take it?
No.
No.
President Clinton.
Oh, my goodness.
President Clinton, and what an experience that was. We were told to arrive at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't until 4 o'clock in the afternoon that we were ushered into the Oval Office, first time I had ever seen it. And I promise you, it is as beautiful and stunning, much more so than television cameras can possibly relay. There were two chairs in front of the fireplace, oval doors on the side through which President Clinton came blasting through, saying, "My allergies are killing me." And his eyes were watering. He sat next to me and said, "All right, Diane, what are we going to talk about?" And the only thing that made news that day, New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, at the end of the interview, and this was after Monica Lewinsky, I said to him, "Mr. President, how have 8 years in the White House affected your marriage?" And he said, "Oh, it's been wonderful. We sit out on the balcony, the Truman balcony, on Sunday mornings with our legs up on the railings, reading all the newspapers. It's absolutely been wonderful." And that was what newspapers picked up on. What can I say? I want to correct something you've said.
Okay.
When I came into public radio, was fortunate enough to have preceded me, Susan Stamberg.
That's true.
Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, Cokie Roberts. I mean, public radio has always had strong female voices. So in that sense, I never felt intimidated by the men who were around me. We had a female manager at WAMU who was fabulous. So in that sense, I felt quite comfortable as a woman.
Well, let's talk about comfort, because it's one thing to interview the President of the United States in your environment, in your studio, but to walk into the Oval Office, that's his environment,
and
or hers, as the case may be
you
in the future.
Bet.
What is that like? Because first of all, he is the most powerful person on the planet. You are a radio talk show host. Let's put things in perspective here.
Yeah, right.
And you're in his home. So how does that impact the interview process, what you feel you can ask, how many buttons you can push?
I didn't think of it in that way. I walked in after waiting for 3 hours and was told by Secret Service, "You've got 2 minutes to set up." And here the engineers, you know,
right.
thinking, how can we do this as quickly as possible? I felt curiously calm at that moment when I sat and waited for him to come through those doors. We had seen each other many times right. before, so it was not the first time he and I had talked personally. So the idea of questions for him, I and my staff had really mapped out beforehand, and I had no hesitation. He is a human being, and I think that that is what we as citizens forget about these people in high places. They are human. They are powerful in terms of how the world will evolve, but they are human beings.
Isn't that the secret of all of this that you do, that Terry Gross does, that we do on this program? You, if you listen carefully enough, as an interviewer and as a listener, you learn that these people are just people.
Exactly. Whether they're movie stars, whether they're diplomats, whether they're soldiers, generals, they're all human beings. And frankly, that's where I differ, pardon me, with Terry Gross. I like to have people in the studio. There are times when, because someone cannot be in the studio, they do need to be on the phone, in which case, and I don't know if you've tried this yet, we were the first in the public radio system to do it. I have people on by Skype.
Mm. No, we've never done that.
So that I can see them. I need to see their body language. I need to know when they're dying to jump in on the conversation. And that is a way we can engage everybody in what we do.
I think Skype requires something other than Windows 95. So give generously so we can upgrade our operating system.
Great idea.
Let's talk a little bit about the presidential race. You have been on the radio for a long time and in Washington, and having grown up in Washington, local news is national news. That's just how it is. When I actually moved to South Carolina in the 70s, it shocked me how politics, and Washington politics in particular, was of particularly no interest to anybody outside of the presidential election years. The tenor of the political conversation in this country
this year
particularly has just gone into the mud.
Ballistic.
Why do you think that is?
I think there are several things at work. Some of the very strong and loud voices on conservative talk radio have generated that kind of anger and have generated that kind of response from their audiences. The whole tenor of conversation, let's leave out the presidential election for the moment, but the tenor of the conversation in this country has grown louder mm-hmm. and angrier. Mm-hmm. And what has happened is that the presidential candidates have fed into that and have begun to lead, stand in the front of that anger and cheer it on.
But why do you suppose people who have available to them as unbiased conversations as possible, like those that appear on your show and elsewhere on NPR and other commercial outlets, why do people gravitate toward the bloviators? And people,
because they're gravitating toward those with whom they agree. public radio listeners have a broader range of interests, ideas, and are willing to listen. I think those who gravitate toward conservative public radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh, like Sean Hannity, are again in total agreement with what those hosts have to say and have cordoned themselves off in a way from those who are voices in public radio, who are liberal in the best sense of the word, Mike. I have always thought of liberals as those being open to a range of ideas. I think what has happened on conservative talk radio is a closing around of a few central core ideas. For example, government is bad. I mean, that started, if I may be so bold, with Ronald Reagan, who said, government is not the answer, it's the problem. And that idea has grown and allowed these voices to take hold. That's what I think has happened, and those loudest voices in this election, most especially Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, the way they have conducted this presidential election, I believe, is really harmful to the discussion in civil manner of good, strong civic ideas.
I know you've spoken to Hillary Clinton on the air.
Many times.
As a presidential candidate?
No.
Okay. Have you spoken, I know you spoke, you tried to speak to Martin O'Malley, who made the serious error of not showing up for your program.
He was a little late. Yeah. He was a little late. But I must say, he redeemed himself on that program. I thought he was terrific in his response to questions, to callers. Yes, I chastised him for being late because as a governor, seemed to me he ought to know how bad traffic was between Baltimore and Washington and therefore arriving 20 minutes late for a live radio program seemed a bit careless.
Have you spoken with Donald Trump?
Not yet.
Never. Not even as a businessman or host of The Apprentice.
Never.
Because you've spoken to so many different kinds of people in so many different lines of work. Personalities, recording people, as I said in the beginning, all these different people. Do you have a favorite? Is there something about a particular line of work and the people that are in that line of work that fascinates you more than others?
I would have to say two of my favorite people, one living, the other passed on. Mm. Former President Jimmy Carter and Fred Rogers.
I know you love Fred Rogers.
I adored Fred Rogers.
Now, you knew him on a level that we only know him from television and from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. What was it about Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, that you love so much?
You know, I did not have the opportunity to meet him face to face. As a homemaker, I used to save my ironing until the end of the day and seat my children in front of the television to turn on Mr. Rogers. I believe that he taught us all what it is to be human. He taught us how to accept and understand and be with those who are different from ourselves. He taught us to respect the mailman, to laugh with young children, to cry with young children. He taught us what it was to be human. Mm-hmm. With former President Jimmy Carter, the honesty that came from that man and still comes from him, having gone through a period of brain cancer, which he shared with us, having gone through immunotherapy, which he has shared with us, two incredibly wonderful human beings.
You have done programs on every conceivable topic, I'm certain, because I know that I have. But according to the Washington Post, here are some of the show topics that you avoid. Shakespeare. We've done several. abortions, gun control, and physics. Why? Why physics? I understand abortion and gun control. There's no middle ground. So why physics?
Because I think it's too abstract for radio. I think that with television and someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson in New York, mm-hmm. explaining and demonstrating what is going on in the universe, that to me is where physics belong. If I had gone to college, I would never have taken a course in physics.
And Shakespeare, you live in the home of the Folger Shakespeare Library. So why not Shakespeare?
Because I think our audience, for the most part, would rather dwell on current and not quite so ancient literature, though I do understand how important Shakespeare is in literature and how important it is to young people to understand what the bard wrote. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm more into this century.
We're going to talk about some of your writing in a moment or two, because you have a fourth book coming out. I don't know when you have time to do these things, to write these books, but you've written four books. We'll talk about that. But first, let me share with you some comments that have come in on Facebook and Twitter as we've been talking. Tim, Diane is a national treasure. It's a thrill to have her in Charlotte during these crazy times. She models civility, curiosity, and intellectual honesty. Her show is one of substance day in and day out, and her listeners know that Diane has their interest at heart when she picks topics and asks questions. Bravo.
Thank you.
And Lynn emails, I will miss you horribly. Have been a fan for years. I want to thank you for speaking up about your voice disorder, because I, too, was diagnosed with spasmodic dysphonia. We're going to come back and talk about that as well, because many people don't understand. They don't even realize you have that condition. We'll come back in a moment. It's Diane Rehm on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg County Park and Recreation. Today at First Ward Park features music by Todd Johnson and the Revolvers, yard games, and fun for the entire family. Open to the public, UptownCharlotteParks.com. Donald Trump now has enough delegates to clinch the Republican nomination, according to the Associated Press. A State Department review criticizes Hillary Clinton's use of private email servers, and 11 states sue the federal government over a transgender bathroom directive, which all started here. Those are some of the topics they'll be talking about in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Weekly News Roundup on The Diane Rehm Show. And by the way, our Weekly News Roundup will return to this program, to this slot, next Friday at 9 o'clock. When we come back, more with Diane Rehm. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's your time. Email us, use Facebook or Twitter.
Martin Grable, president and CEO of Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, talks about underwriting on WFAE.
We get to support a community-based public radio station reaching a diverse group of local listeners. And I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and say they've heard our message on WFAE.
For more information, email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Diane Rehm, host of the Diane Rehm Show on NPR and on this station every day at 10 and 11, is our guest. She's doing the Round the World tour here as she prepares to move on to the next stage of her life following the election in November. We are streaming this live on Facebook. You can find WFAE on Facebook to watch if you'd like to. And our weekly news roundup will continue in this time slot next week. Let's talk just a brief moment, because you've addressed this a great number of times on your show, but I find that people still don't know that you have something called spasmodic dysphonia. And if they heard the interview that you rarely play back old shows, but if they heard the interview that you did, I think, with Shirley Temple, that you played back not too long ago, it was, only through the cadence of your delivery did I realize it was you doing the interview, because that was before spasmodic dysphonia. Tell people what this is.
Well, it began with a series of coughs. I kept going in the middle of interviews. Mm-hmm. And I think it began with taking too much Advil. And Senator Barbara Mikulski told me at the time that when her committee debated whether to make Advil an over-the-counter drug, they knew that that was a condition that could develop and and hesitated. In any case, I began going to doctors who started putting tubes down my throat. They all said it was in my head. The cough not only worsened, but my voice began to strangle. Mm-hmm. So it was very hard to get words out. And finally, one day, I could barely talk. And so I had to go downtown after I did the show to do a program before about 350 people. I ran back to my office. I said to my boss, I'm out of here. I've got to find out what's going on with my voice. I sat at home, Mike, for 4 months, unwilling to speak with anyone except my husband. I wouldn't even answer the phone. My doctor finally called John and said, we've got to send her to Johns Hopkins to see if there's throat cancer, ALS, Parkinson's, something that has been missed. And in 1 hour at Johns Hopkins, a neurologist and an otolaryngologist determined that I had spasmodic dysphonia. It begins by the basal ganglia of the brain sending an incorrect message to the vocal cord, telling them, in my type of spasmodic dysphonia, which is the AD, as in David, adductor type, telling the voice to clamp down inappropriately. There is no cure. Instead, every 4 months, I receive an injection of Botox right into where you'd think the Adam's apple lies. First, they give me an injection of a painkiller, which doesn't kill the pain. And then they put in a much longer needle and move it around so that it hits both sides of the vocal folds. And then I'm fine for another 4 months.
And they're putting Botox. They're using Botox. And what does that do? Paralyze the vocal cords
Temporarily. And then they come back together and begin to vibrate normally. Takes me about 10 days to 2 weeks to get back on the air.
And I know you said it does not hurt to talk, but do you have to concentrate on talking now to make sure that your vocal folds don't close up?
Once I've had the injection, I just talk.
Okay.
I can hear when that Botox is wearing off.
Yeah.
I hear those cracks beginning to come again, and it's pretty much a four-month schedule.
You're a person who depends on your voice.
You bet.
To do your job. No voice, no job. What did that do to your brain? What went through your mind when you were going through these months and months and months of not knowing what was wrong? And even when you found out what was wrong, there's no cure. What went through your mind?
I wondered whether listeners would turn on the radio and say, "What in God's name is that woman doing on the air?" And many did, and still do. But my station and my boss were so sympathetic and understanding, and so was that audience. The first day I came back on the air, I brought in my own doctors. I brought the doctor from Johns Hopkins. I brought my psychiatrist. I brought my medical doctor. And I brought a voice therapist, all to talk about this affliction. And lo and behold, around the country, people who'd had this, who didn't know what it was, went to their doctors, and the doctors said, "You have what Diane Rehm has." So it was not only an education for me, but for doctors and patients around the country.
You wrote a book about this called Finding My Voice. It's about a lot of things, but that's a big part of it. You've also written a book about your marriage to your late husband, John, Toward Commitment, A Dialogue About Marriage, which we've talked about on this program, and you're about to publish.
No, it's already,
out there. Okay, excuse me.
Already out.
Misinformed, am I? A fourth book called On My Own, about your husband's death.
You forgot the book about Maxie. I wrote a book about
Chihuahua?
My little dog, my long-haired Chihuahua.
I'm told that dog is not friendly.
That's exactly right. He is very protective of me. But you're right. My new book called On My Own is about John's death, how he died, and our marriage.
Was writing that book, particularly difficult for you, or was it a catharsis?
I began writing the book, Mike, the night John was dying. I was trying to sleep on two chairs by his side. He had chosen to die, and the only way he could do that in Maryland was to stop eating, taking medication, and drinking water. And it took 10 days. And I was there that last night because I had a feeling he was going to go that night. So I was on two chairs at his bedside with Maxie on my stomach. And by 2 a.m., I gave up trying to sleep. I had my iPad with me and got up and began writing about my rage at a system in this country which would not allow John, who suffered terribly from Parkinson's, to die quickly.
Yeah. You were on this program. We did a show on the right to die, and we had you on to talk about this because this has become a topic very near and dear to your heart, and one that I know that in retirement, or if that's what you're going to call it, retirement.
No, stepping away from the microphone.
Well, when you step away from the microphone on a daily basis, one of the things you intend to do, I'm told, is to increase your activity in this Right to Die movement, which has gotten you in a little hot water with NPR because of NPR hosts don't take positions on things. Explain to people who may be on the other side of this Right to Die issue why this is a good idea.
Here is my presentation. And I really thought long and hard about this. I think rather than calling it the right to die, it should be called the right to choose. Because if you believe that God is the only one who can make that decision for you, I support you. If you believe that what you want is all possible care, every radiation, every chemotherapy, every palliative care possible, I support you. And if you believe that you have come to the end of your life and doctors concur that you have come toward the end of your life and you are ready to relinquish your life, which is what John did, I support you. My point is each of us deserves the right to choose.
Were you there? Were you in that position prior to John's going through this?
Or absolutely. And John and I had talked about this so much because both of our sets of parents had died in ways. My mother died at 49 when I was 19. My father died of a broken heart 11 months later. John's father took his own life. His mother took her own life. So that talk of death and choosing death, as John's father and mother both did, was very much in our minds. And we talked about this with our children, saying to them and to each other that we would always be there to support each other if that time came.
And your daughter, she's a physician, isn't she?
Exactly.
How did she react to this?
She said to her dad in that conversation we had with the doctor, our son, our daughter, and me, "But Dad, we can keep you comfortable." And John said, "I can no longer feed myself. I can no longer bathe myself. I can no longer take care of myself in any way. I don't want comfort. I am ready to die."
In writing that book and others, you've been very, very candid about yourself, about your personal life, things that you have gone through, things you have thought. And as a public person, that strikes me as something as being not dangerous, but just uncomfortable, because you're already public enough, and yet to let people into your private areas seems to be, I don't know the word for it, quite honestly, Diane, but you were very honest about your relationship with your late husband, who you were married to for 54 years. You look back on it fondly, the time, but he was emotionally abusive to you, and you write about that in your book.
I write
Why?
About what our marriage was, a marriage that had its glorious highs and true lows. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did that, Mike, is that I wanted to be honest and open and realistic about our marriage, because I wanted to convey the thought that even a marriage of 54 years is not perfect, because there are no perfect marriages. There are no perfect people. I am not anywhere near perfect. John was nowhere near perfect. But we loved each other enormously and deeply. We were two very, very different personalities. I far more gregarious. He one who adored silence and being alone.
Mm.
And tried to blend those two personalities and characteristics is not easy, but we managed.
We only have about 40 seconds left, but in that time, what is there about you that you think would surprise listeners? I mean, I know that you don't drink wine, and you made very clear that when you came here last night, we had a little event for you last night. I don't drink wine, but I do drink champagne. Nothing pricey, but champagne.
Exactly.
You don't have a fancy car because you'd rather spend it on clothes. That must come from your fashion model year. And 60 years ago, you played second base with the State Department softball team. That was surprising.
And John Rehm was the pitcher for the men's softball team. That's how we got our first date. We made a bet on the World Series. I won. He took me out to dinner. That was our first date.
Diane Rehm, host of The Diane Rehm Show and soon to be host of her own podcast once she steps away from the microphone. Good luck on the next chapter of your life.
Oh, Mike, thank you so much. It's been great to be with you.